Greetings from K9 to Tiddly-dum, Tiddly-dum, Tiddly-dum. End of message.
Just a quick note to let you know that this podcast was recorded on the 25th of September, but owing to various things getting in the way, it's only now that we've been able to put it online. Happy day, faithless listeners, and welcome to episode 171 of the Diddly Dum Podcast, the fourth best Doctor Who podcast out there. I'm Doc.
I'm Hayden.
I'm Mark.
You want me to say hello? Hello, I'm Tim.
And we have with us, faithless listeners, for a rare Whoseum episode, which is the whole point for which the Whoseum was originally brought into being, Mr. Tim Burrows of the Missing Episodes podcast. Welcome, Tim.
Well, what an honour. What an honour. I'm on the Mighty Diddly Dum podcast. I was thinking back, actually. I don't always listen in the month it comes out, but I will binge episodes to catch up. I'm up to date with Terence Dix at the moment. When was the last Whoseum? Have I missed one?
The last Whoseum would have been...
What a great question.
Hang on, I've got a note here somewhere.
Wasn't Simon Britt, was it? With the no, that was the comics.
No, it would have been... Mark from the 42 to Doomsday podcast brought along David Banks' Cybermen book.
Ah, that's a while ago.
And that was in... Hang on, that's not that long ago, actually. Our Mark brought along his Tetrap gun.
Ah, yes.
Kang crossbow.
Yeah. actual real things. Was that just after I was married? Because I think I was on... Was I on honeymoon? So I remember listening to it.
I think what we've done is we did a series of episodes which were effectively had a little bit of a Whoseum thing bolted onto the end. So, it looks like the last formal one was, gosh, almost exactly 3 years ago.
Wow. Yeah, I told you. Yeah, it would have been when I got married.
Yes, and in fact, it was exactly the episode which began with our television commentary on your wedding highlights, Hayden. And after what's been happening in the UK in recent weeks, don't worry, Hayden, we'll be there for your funeral as well. So.
Oh, why, thank you, Tom. What else are friends there for, hey?
Yeah.
Previously on Diddly Dum.
And now here comes the groom. Hayden driving the Whomobile slowly through the great crowd, waving happily as he goes. He draws up outside the church. And out steps Hayden. And as is his right as a Diddly Dum podcaster, the groom is resplendent in the full dress uniform and false moustache of an honorary unit brigadier. Hayden returning the salute there of the Guard of Honour, made up today of members of the Queen's Own Johnny Who Entertainers. And now, in accordance with centuries of tradition, the groom is met at the west door by the Bishop of Mummerset and by the Managing Director of Creswell's Biscuits. The Bishop, of course, representing the fleeting temporal power of life here on Earth, I'm the managing director representing the eternal spiritual power of confectionery. And then Brendan came along from Australia.
Oh, Brenny.
Yeah.
Brenny!
Oh, we're going to have to oil the Hoosium doors, aren't we, if we haven't been in there in 3 years?
Oh, yeah. Well, something might already be prepared to be happening there.
Ah.
Right. So,
Yes, apologies. I didn't mean to sidetrack everyone then on trying to remember what happened when. But yeah, great honour to be here. It's one of the few Doctor Who podcasts I listen to without fail.
Oh, thank you very much.
Right. So I was going to say, what has been happening since last we were? Well, quite a lot, obviously.
Ooh.
In fact, I think the day after we last recorded was when we lost the Queen. So it's been all been slightly chaotic since then. In fact, wasn't your firm involved in?
Yeah, the company I work for, who I don't think it's common knowledge, so I won't mention the company's name. But we printed and pressed the order of service for the funeral. Haven't seen it, mind. But then again, I haven't been in work this week. I've been. Mixture of illness and holiday have contributed, so.
It was all perfectly spelled, so I thought, well, he didn't have anything to do with that.
Wow. Yeah. Says my ex-proofreader there, ladies and gentlemen.
Well, Mark and I were handed our copies when we entered the Abbey, weren't we, Mark?
Mm.
Mummerset being an independent enclave, we got our invitations. Oh, we weren't meant to tell Hayden that, were we?
What?
Right, so. So I'd imagine that there's not been much going on Doctor Who-wise with the four of us in the last couple of weeks, has there?
No.
Not necessarily, no. No. Although I do have something which will warm the heart of Mark John.
That could do with warming in these approaching autumnal nights.
Well, listeners to our... Well, long-term listeners to our podcast may remember that something that particularly grinds Mark gears is the ever-changing aspect ratios of old TV shows.
Oh, I wonder what you're going to say.
Yeah, instead of being 4.3, they go then to 16.9, and everything's all stretched, and it sets you off, doesn't it?
Heresy.
Yeah, brings them out in hives if the wind's blowing in the right direction. Well, ITV Hub have just uploaded the classic series of Thunderbirds.
Uh-huh.
Right.
Not only that, but they're HD remastered, and they're in 4.3.
Oh, lovely.
And since my young son has developed a real fascination with Thunderbirds, it's now much easier to watch that than it was to get the DVD and Blu-ray down all the time, and in much better quality as well. And weirdly enough, that quality of print... for all 32 episodes of the original series, were only available, I think it was in America and Japan. And if you wanted to buy them over here, you had to get a downgraded version, which was stretched to 16.9.
Oh.
That ITV Hub had classic Doctor Who on there for about 24 hours, bizarrely.
Yes, I noticed that, yeah. Very strange. What series did they say it was as well?
Seasons 1 to 4, I do believe.
The classic series.
Yeah.
So that's bizarre. So I go for the mostly missing series.
There's an explanation for this. Some of the stuff that is on Britbox is obviously owned by ITV.
Mm.
And ITV and BBC have split with Britbox. There's something else that's coming called ITV Infinity, I think it's called, or something like that anyway.
Oh.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons why things were accidentally uploaded and showing for that period of time. But I never got onto an episode, did you, Tim? Because I tried clicking on some.
No, I only saw the reaction online.
Oh, right. Even though I've seen them all millions of times, but anyway. Would have been good to watch them on ITV. I mean, Doctor Who on ITV is just weird.
Perverse, I say.
It's like when The Simpsons moved to Channel 4. It just doesn't feel right. Or Neighbours moving to Channel 5. It's like, what's it doing there?
I'd say it's against the natural order of things. I don't like it.
Yeah.
Does it have stops for adverts?
No. I mean, the Thunderbirds episodes are like 50 minutes long, but the only adverts you get are at the start of the episode. So there's no ad breaks in between. So that's pretty decent, actually. Especially when you've got a toddler wanting to watch it.
I did something rather fun in the last 4 weeks, and I never do anything. And I know your listeners don't care and don't know who I am, but I did something fun, Doctor Who-ish, which I'll tell you about. I did my first BFI visit. It was related to the Abominable Snowmen.
Was this why I saw a picture of you on Twitter at one of the Canterbury Railway stations, and you said you're doing a thing?
Yes, but we didn't go to the animation. We didn't go to the screening because we didn't have tickets. So a small group of us decided to use the time that we weren't in the BFI to do a locations tour of the towns of Wang Chiang. So we mooched about Clink Street and Wapping and saw the steps and picked our way across, I don't know, 6 or 7 locations, and then made it to the BFI where we joined for the quiz afterwards and got sloshed and met all sorts of people who are familiar online but not necessarily in the flesh. And as someone who doesn't go to conventions or, you know, get out and about and meet other Doctor Who fans face to face, it was brilliant.
Oh.
It was fantastic. And we won the quiz.
Oh.
Yeah, no, really good. So I might be going to crash the after party of the Time Meddler as well.
Nice.
Which is in a month.
Oh, brilliant. Excellent.
Yeah, so it was fantastic. I stood where the TARDIS dematerialised, or materialised rather, in Talons. That was nice.
Mm.
I saw the spot where Mr. Sin jumps out in episode 1, stood there. It's the site of the Clink Museum now, which is a completely fictitious museum, in that there's no evidence there was a prison ever there, but they've made it look like one. But yeah, it was a lovely day out. Really good.
Oh, you can't beat a spot of location visiting,
yeah.
I think. It's always good fun, very enjoyable. Obviously, my favourite is still the village of Oldbourne.
Oh, I've never been.
Which was Devil's End. In the
That was a glorious weekend, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. I've been several times now. And, yes.
A glorious ketchup-stained weekend.
Yeah. I remember the last time I remember the second time I went, which was with my eldest daughter Polly, and I just sprinted round and round the green. I gambled around excitedly.
Every time you go, does someone make the joke? Oh, they've rebuilt the church then?
Yes, exactly.
I would be that guy.
It's lovely though, but it's weird, just especially hanging around. It's especially weird hanging around in the graveyard, but yeah, it's because you see so many of the photos and the promotional photos, and you can. And it is odd standing in those exact spots, and it's hardly changed at all.
Mm.
And it's, it's lovely. I mean, it's closest you can get to visiting the set. It really does feel like you've walked into the episode. I haven't done any London locations apart from looking up at the post office tower.
Yeah.
Well, what about the stairs from Frontier in Space are just outside the BFI?
Oh, yes, of course. Yes, I've done those, but not because they were Doctor Who, just because that happened to be the way I was going.
And my office used to be based round about where a lot of the street work was filmed for Remembrance.
Nah.
You know, where the Daleks are sort of wobbling over the cobbles.
Yeah.
Going under bridges.
I think we brought this up on the podcast before, but for about 10 years, I didn't realise that my local... Well, my favourite pub in Cambridge was the pub that Tom Baker gets chased down by the huge ball from the mouse in Sharda. It was between the Mitre and the Baron of Beef. And the Mitre was the one I used to frequent. Back in the day, you know, I was very, very drunk.
The Baron of Beef? That rings a bell. Did all the crew get faced in there? I think they might have.
Yeah, they were still, they were still in there 20 years later when I was. It was amazing.
Yeah, waiting for the studio session to
get scheduled. Exactly, yeah.
Well, something has happened since last we assembled with Chris Chibnall's trademark adroit sense for getting the maximum publicity for Doctor Who. He waited to announce the title of the next episode and the date of the next episode until the middle of state mourning for a monarch who'd reigned for 70 years. He's not daft, Chris, you know. Power of the Doctor. What do we think of it?
You know what's going to happen, don't you? At some point there's going to be a line of dialogue. It'll probably be Yaz, and she'll go, "You see, it wasn't the power of the Doctor that saved the day. It was the power of the Doctor's friends that was inside us all the time." And it'll be something like that. And it'll just be...
Oh, do you think so?
And you'll have swelling music at that point, and then she'll turn into a phoenix and fly away because she was a bird all the time or something. I don't know. I don't know. Chris Chibnall, eh?
So does Jodie actually regenerate in this one? Do we know?
Yeah, apparently.
But are we not sure into whom she's regenerating?
I don't know.
No, we're not.
Well, the thing is, they can't have her regenerating into Shooty and then into Tennant, can they? Because Shooty's presumably got to be the final incarnation, hasn't she, at the end of the conveyor belt?
You'd like to think so, but I don't know. I'm starting to feel more and more with this David Tennant coming back for the centenary. For the 60th. I mean, I think Jodie's going to regenerate into him. The episode will end with, "What? What? What?" And then that'll be the end of the episode. And then it'll just be like, "Oh, no." I don't really like Doctor Who right now, as as everyone can attest, really.
Well, I
think it's going to be but there you go.
It is strange that you have a show which is semi-permanently on hiatus, it seems. And when it does come back, the last time it came back, it was for half a dozen episodes. And then, when was that? Last year at some point? I've lost track of time with it. And that's the problem,
isn't it? Last year, wasn't it? I think it was. It was around Halloween.
But that's the problem. Whether you like Chibnall's Who or not, you can't put it out once every couple of years and not mention it in the gaps.
Yeah.
Because I know I'm of a different era, but I was watching Doctor Who when I was 4. I wouldn't have watched Doctor Who if I was 4, and then 6 when it was next on, and nobody talked about it, and then 8, and then 10, and then 14. It's very strange.
Yeah, my friend, I've talked about this on podcasts before, but she has two young daughters who were, I think they were 7 and 10, so probably 8 and 11 by now, but they both quite enjoyed the first series of Jodie Whittaker's and were quite excited to see a female doctor. But then there was that big gap and they took a bit of prompting to get back into it again. But after the second series, they were back into it again. And then I think really by the time The Flux came round, they just were like, you know, they'd moved on. Been and gone. I mean, they did watch it, but they weren't so interested, and you know, they got bored quicker, and they struggled to follow quite a lot of the story, I think, as well. And I just don't think the impetus or the motivation was there after such a big break and seeing so few episodes.
Yeah, it's strange. It just adds to the narrative that they're writing for fans and not a wider audience, doesn't it? And you know, we're seeing the results of that in that nobody's watching.
No.
Sadly.
When we last had our own Matt Charlton on, he was managing a group of tour guides around Media City in Salford, wasn't he? And you got kids walking past a TARDIS and Daleks and not even
knowing what
showing
they were.
A flicker of recognition.
The most interesting for me was the kids' tours, which I'm not very good at because I'm not really a kiddie person. You know, I'm the crazy uncle in the attic. But our tour starts by a replica of the TARDIS, which has been done up to represent Jodie Whittaker's TARDIS now. It's not a Doctor Who thing, it's just a useful meeting point because you'd hope that if somebody got lost or didn't know where they were going, the majority of people would know you meet at the TARDIS, you know, and that you'd know what that is. And in our exhibition room, we have two Daleks, which I gather were used in Asylum of the Daleks and a few other stories as well, when they all got shipped off down to Cardiff for those Dalek Parliament scenes. And the kids just don't know what they are. They don't recognise
them. I've heard this.
Oh.
And I don't want to get into knocking... Personally, I think the series... I was quite critical of Stephen Moffat's era. I've actually gone back, rewatched them, enjoyed a lot of them. I think the Jodie Whittaker era, I don't think the show has looked better at all in terms of its cinematography and effects. I think the storylines are fine. I don't have a problem with the Timeless Children. I think that validates every kid who's ever run around a school playground pretending to be Doctor Who. Possibly, it's just come a little bit late in the day. Now that the kids aren't watching on a Sunday. They don't know what it is. You know, I made the couple of gags about the TARDIS and the Daleks, and it was one of the first couple of times they fell flat. I just thought to myself, ooh, that's a problem for the show. But I do find it alarming. They know what Strictly is. They know what Blue Peter is. You know, no disrespect to Blue Peter, there's less than a million people watching that.
Yeah.
But they don't know what the TARDIS is. They were more excited, and again, I've been in that sphere, so I'm not knocking it, but they were more excited about the little Albert Square mock-up and the countdown clock. They recognise those, but they don't recognise an icon that's been on TV for over 50 years. That's worrying.
Mm. That surely is disturbing, isn't it? Because when, in 2005, I don't think kids just started watching Doctor Who. I think it was the parents making them watch it. And if those kids don't grow up to be parents with memories of Doctor Who, lordy.
Yeah, I think you probably hit the nail on the head there. If the mums and dads aren't sitting down the children to watch it, then the viewing figures are drifting away.
Yes, I've detected that you're all not fans of the Jodie Whittaker era.
Has it leaked out?
Well, it's just the subtle signs, you know, when you're reviewing your episodes. You just put one and one together and very firmly get two.
Do you know what's even worse than that is the fact that I think, to a man, we've all tried to be fairly... Well, we've all tried to be fair with it. And we've all really wanted to like it.
Mm.
But we just haven't. I mean, we're not even all three of us of the same age. You can't level the whole, oh, you're an old fan kind of, you know, thing in us. And, oh, you're from the dark times. You go, oh, bring back Tom Baker, all is forgiven, all this. You know, it's so... I mean, we're adding nothing new to the podcast here, but it's so vanilla. It's not exciting. I think I've been very underwhelmed. Having said that, there have been some very good episodes. One or two every series, I'd say. But apart from that... But then I think everything's a bit like that at the minute. You know, I've been watching stuff this year like, you know, Star Trek Discovery, some of the Marvel series that have come out this year, and She-Hulk, you know, Obi-Wan, Miss Marvel... One of them obviously not being a Marvel one, but there you go. And I just think all of them have been a bit meh.
You see, the mistake you're making, Hayden, is not anchoring your viewing habits firmly in the 60s and 70s, like me.
Absolutely. Do you know what? You're right. All I need is three channels and a TV that's continually on the blink and lots of Roger Moore. And I think I'll actually be happy with that. Less choice. Yeah, less choice.
Anything more than three channels I've always thought to be frivolous and possibly even satanic.
So anyway, Power of the Doctor is going to be broadcast, I think, now on the Sunday the 23rd of October.
Oh, yes, we're talking about
October.
Doctor Who, aren't we? Of course, sorry.
Sunday the 23rd of October. So we shall all look forward to that Jodie Swan song.
What day was that again, Doc, so I can make sure I'm out?
Sunday the 23rd of October.
Right, okay, I've written that on my hand.
Right, so I was prepared to progress to the Whoseum.
Mm-hmm.
Start of the show. Well, listeners, as you may well remember, the founding purpose of the Whoseum is that we are the biggest Doctor Who museum in existence. And occasionally, more frequently in the past, we invited guests on to bring and present a bit of Doctor Who memorabilia for exhibition at the Whoseum and to talk about it. And what we will do now is we'll sort of make our way into our enormous main exhibition hall. So, just computer, could you open the doors, please?
Yes, Doc.
Hello? Doors weren't open. There's something wrong with the doors.
Aww.
Mark?
Hmm?
We'll try again. You've given up smoking, haven't you? When the doors open, slip your lighter into the crack, will you?
Oh, okay. Hello.
All right.
Well, as they say.
Computer, could you open the doors, please?
Yes, Doc.
Thank you. Right, in we go.
What is happening? Why do not their doors close?
You're not too overawed, are you, Tim?
I am speechless.
I am speechless.
Just breathe in that atmosphere.
I'm glad you're taking it like this. Some people get quite upset when they find they're to have the operation. It's just a simple lobotomy, otherwise you won't survive in the world of podcasting. Tim, what is the first item that you have brought along with you?
The first item I have brought along is a small collection of Doctor Who hardbacks.
Oh, I've got to stop you. He's got little Yetis.
Do you want to look at the Yetis?
Yes, please. Oh!
Wow, look at that.
Gosh.
Oh, I want Yetis.
I think everyone's bored of me talking about these, but B, my partner, I was stuck at work for 2 weeks, basically, doing from 6 a.m. till midnight, and I was pretty hacked off with life. And she made one of these for me while I was there. So when I got back...
Oh, they made? They're not...
That's made. Bored. That's made.
That's fantastic.
She made the feet and the hands out of clay and baked them and painted them. And then made a, what do you call it, an armature out of wire. And then stuffed it and then bought the fur and painted the fur. And so that one's mine. And then she's made another one, which is partly done. But she's going to look at cutting a flap here and putting a clay mounting in to put a ball bearing inside.
Yes. Wow.
But they're amazing.
I would have to say the other half is very talented. I see her on Twitter quite often. She's the person who does wonderful portraits on the title pages of the novels, doesn't she? The Target novelization.
She gets a knackered old Target, rips out the title page, and then does a portrait on there of usually a female companion, but she's going to start doing the Doctor's.
So, Tim, please restart by telling us what it is you brought to the museum. Your first item.
First item I have is a very small collection of Doctor Who hardbacks. And these are the original 1964 and 1965 Muller novelizations. So, in 1964, David Whittaker did An Exciting Adventure with the Daleks, and that was reprinted a number of times. The first one has a pink dust jacket, and I don't have the dust jacket, so I'm willing to pay a ridiculous price for a pristine pink dust jacket. And when I say I'm willing to pay, what I mean is the Hooseum is willing to pay a ridiculous amount of money to get this collection absolutely tip-top complete.
Sorry, Tim, the moths have just escaped from our purse again.
So there are four editions of Doctor Who in An Exciting Adventure with the Daleks, because there is one of each imprint.
Which edition has the grey cover? Because
that's the second printing of An Exciting Adventure with the Daleks.
Yes.
The first one was pink.
Because that's the one I have that, so I've got the second printing.
Whoa. Yeah. Okay. So the one I'm donating is signed by Richard Martin.
Oh, wow.
It devalues it by about 50%. In 1965, they did Doctor Who and the Crusaders.
Hmm.
And again in 1965... they did Doctor Who and the Zabi. And these are the first Doctor Who novels, novelizations. And I thought they'd go very well in the library section.
Well, what we'll do is we'll put them in a corner of their own because they are so significant. We can call that the Muller Corner.
Yeah, maybe I'll stop developing that idea. I was going to involve fruit, but I think that would be beneath my dignity.
So the pink copy then is the very first one from 64. So what is that older than the copy, that sort of like pastel drawing of the Doctor on a hill?
Yes.
With the, is it really?
Yeah, that's the Armada. That's the first paperback edition. That was, I don't know the year.
I have that as well.
But that was done after that. And then there was an American one with one of the toy Daleks with like sparkler going off as well. You can find that about. I've got it somewhere.
The Armada copy was released in October 1965.
There you go. So after these three.
So 11 months after. Yeah, so that's incredible.
But that grey one of the Daleks, that artwork on the front, I saw that. It reminded me very much. God, that looks so much like the sort of artwork you used to get. Well, maybe artwork in inverted commas in like the Dalek annuals or the Doctor Who annuals.
And there are illustrations within as well, and they're superb. They're photographs, basically, which have been inked over. And these carry over to the paperback Target novels. Yeah.
I could just say they look familiar.
So when you have your Target paperback of Doctor Who and the Daleks, it's the same text. You know, it's the same book, but this was an original in 1964. And the three of them form a little time capsule because, you know, when Bill Strutton finished The Range in 1965, nobody knew this would be going on forever and ever and ever. And they're setting their own little universe as well. So in an exciting adventure with the Daleks, they have to justify why Ian and Barbara get on board the TARDIS. So there's a car crash. A car crashes into a lorry, I think, in Barnes Common, and Susan is found unconscious, and it's all written in the first person from Ian's perspective. So they cover An Unearthly Child, or that one episode, An Unearthly Child, in about 20 pages, and then they're off to Skaro. And it's brilliant. It's written, it has an innocence about it, because nobody knew what was to come. You know, there's no canon to write about. It's just David Whittaker trying to put it into a story. Inexplicably, the Daleks are tiny in there. They're only 3 foot tall or something like that. They're tiny. In the second one, The Crusade, the Doctor Who and the Crusaders, it starts off trying to justify why Vicky is there and not Susan, and it explains that Susan stayed on Earth and married David Cameron.
Oh, it does, doesn't it?
Yeah.
1 second. I'm just going to check that that's in the paperback. One moment. Hang on.
I think it is.
I did think on An Adventure in Space and Time, where it actually has Bill Hartnell on Barnes Common, isn't it?
Yeah.
Where the policeman taps on the window. And I just think, I wonder how many people recognise the Daleks one. Something differs in quite a number of ways, isn't it? They've got this... the one that I was found most memorable was, and I've read it for... God, over 30 years, is the fact that at the end there's a glass Dalek.
Oh, yeah.
But no, I think it's possibly the first one I ever bought.
Oh,
obviously
really?
In paperback.
Oh, because it's Daleks, obviously, yeah, sure.
I've just had a bit of tragedy happen to me. This is from 1973.
Oh, no!
The Doctor Who and the Crusaders. I just wanted to double check that David Cameron is on page 7, and he is in this one. So. But and in doing so, I've just opened it up, and the first 3 pages have fallen out.
Get it painted on, I say.
Yeah, I was going to say that's fine. Just get your partner to paint portraits of Doctor Who companions on them, and Bob's your uncle.
I have a vague idea that I might have once dropped my Doctor Who and the Daleks into the bath. You know when you do that with a paperback and you leave it to dry and it suddenly balloons outwards? Either that, or it was just an unusually thick compared with all the... You know the ones that Terence used to do towards the end, when they're quite a very thin book?
You must have been a particularly sophisticated 10-year-old reading your Target novel in the bath.
No, this was last week. Why is anyone saying you must have been a particularly sophisticated in a surprised voice? Surely this is assumed, isn't it?
I have to say, Doctor Who and the Daleks was one of the earliest Doctor Who novelisations that I'd read. So, at the time when the Target novelisation is, I don't remember batting an eyelid at the introduction to An Unearthly Child, because I simply wouldn't have known. I wouldn't have known what The Unearthly Child was. So I think one of the things that did stand out about it was the fact that it was written in the first person, which was very different to the other ones.
Mm.
But yeah, that and the Zabi were two of my first Target paperbacks.
The terrific thing about the Zabi is you can understand what the hell is going on. You know, you don't have all that electronic noise over the top, which I detest, frankly, and I find it mostly unwatchable because of the noise. But it's a delightful book. It's the one I last read, I think. The Zabi, this was the first one I acquired, and my parents used to drag me round flea markets when I was, I don't know, 10 or 11 or something like that. My nanny, my mum's mum, was there, and I saw this Doctor Who book, and it was a fiver, and she she forked out for it out of her pension, bless her. Anyway, I fell out of love with Doctor Who as a cool teenager, more interested in girls and later booze. And when I moved to Canterbury, it came down, this book, in many of the boxes that were sent down. And I got online and said, this looks old and rare. And I sold it. And I got 80 quid for it, needed to. But, you know, so that is my biggest regret as a Doctor Who fan, is selling that book because of my personal nostalgia with it. So I've had to fork out for another copy. And that was part of my collecting books phase, where I was trying to get all of the W.H. Allen hardbacks and every imprint of a paperback. Mm. I ended up with boxes and boxes of Target books. 720 of them I had, all individual.
Was that your biggest regret until you just realised that Richard Martin had signed one of the books?
That's as bought, and it's obviously a latter-day signature, and it does devalue it, bless him. I mean,
oh, really?
You know, it's an antique that's been written on. I don't know whether it would be equally devalued if Douglas Canfield had signed one of them, but The Crusade, that might get a few quid.
I managed to buy a copy of Two Doctors DVD signed by Colin Baker online. That was only about £4. It was, you know, cheaper than...
So low at the minute. They're so low. So where did you pick up the other ones then, Tim?
Online.
And they were fairly recently, or...?
No, I abandoned the collect. It was just, it was overtaking the flat. There were piles of books. It would be it would be a daily job getting the parcels, opening them up, seeing what was in, sorting them out into spares and keeps, and then trying to sell on the spares to try and fund more purchases. And eventually I went, enough is enough. And I sold the lot of them. And I just kept the Mullers. So to stop me from selling them, and to stop me from buying more, I'm donating to the museum.
Oh, thank you. Thanks very much.
So your home will be Muller Light from now on, Tim.
Very good.
Tim, when did you move to Canterbury? Were you there in the mid-90s?
2001.
Oh, right, okay. So you wouldn't have been... I was just trying to work out... if you knew the cabal of shady Doctor Who fans whose house I visited in the mid-90s, they had that intriguing cupboard full of VHS tapes that they wouldn't let me look at.
Do you know, that's in my notes, Mark.
Is it?
I did have quite a bizarre experience once where I was in a comic shop in Canterbury trying to buy some Doctor Who stuff for my birthday. And the guy said, I know a collector of Doctor Who memorabilia and stuff. He's selling a load of stuff. Would you like to go and visit his house in Canterbury? I said, yes, please. Sounds amazing. So he phoned this guy up and spoke to him quickly and then said, okay, yeah, I'll have to drive you over there. And because otherwise, you know, you can't just turn up. The guy won't let you in. It was like trying to score drugs, I imagine.
You can't row that back now that you've let slip that you're au fait with the Argo of the demi-monde.
So we drove over to this little suburban estate in Canterbury. There's nothing particularly noticeable about it or memorable. Just ordinary semi-detached house. Guy knocked on the door, the comic book guy, not the one from Simpsons, the actual one from Canterbury. Spoke to the super fan within, and we were admitted into this inner sanctum full of Doctor Who memorabilia. On the wall, there appeared to be what I took to be at the time a Frank Bellamy original.
Oh.
Pretty much the first thing I said to him was, I don't suppose you're selling that, are you? And he gave me such a filthy look and said, I don't think so. And then I was having a look around at some of the stuff he had. He had loads of the Daypole figures, the Dennis Fisher figures. And I looked over in the corner and there was a couple of guys looking in this rather large cupboard. And I could just see from over the other side of the room, this cupboard was stacked from top to toe with VHS video cassettes. And I started edging over to see what they were. And immediately the super fan host, I've no idea who this guy is, just suddenly went, inched over, pushed the door shut so that the people who were looking in it suddenly couldn't look. And he sort of said, sorry, we've got a not we here. So I did presume it was just simply stuff that, I mean, because this would have been around about 93. So there would still have been an awful lot of stuff that was around that hadn't been released on. Oh, that's a shame. I was hoping you might, because I had no idea who these people were. I mean, they were Doctor Who fans, which was, you know.
Apart from me and you, obviously topping the tree of Canterbury-related Doctor Who fans, I only know of one other.
Right.
And that's Stephen James Walker.
Oh.
He's in Canterbury, apparently.
Oh, is he? Well, that's funny, because I went to a book signing in the 90s. One of the Doctor Who, I think it was the 80s book. That came out.
Brilliant.
Yeah, absolutely brilliant. The 60s, 70s and 80s books are some of my favourite books.
I'm looking over at them now longingly.
Yeah, I went to the Waterstones in Canterbury for the signing. And there was a quiz afterwards. There's all these sort of Doctor Who fans all sat around in there and there's a quiz. And I don't know why it was. I've never felt suddenly so embarrassed in all my life. I don't know why. It was like the creeping realisation that I was sat with. I'd become part of these. I was a nerd. I'd become part of this group of. I mean, they all seemed like nice people, but I think up until that point, I'd only ever seen other Doctor Who fans on television being gently mocked by TV presenters as they stood there in their cosplay outfits.
Yeah.
And so to suddenly find myself in a room with other Doctor Who fans was a quite a new and bizarre experience. I think I just suddenly felt incredibly self-conscious and started blushing as they started asking, which Doctor Who story? Blah, 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 blah. I was like, oh, God.
I'm surprised Canterbury, because it's only tiny Canterbury, could muster more than, you know, half a dozen.
Oh, no, the place was full. I mean, I couldn't even get into Tom Baker's book signing. That pissed me off. Although I did get to get my... they did let me in to get my book signed at the end of the talk.
I thought your question was going to be, Mark, so when you moved to Canterbury, did you ever pay for the services of an unusually laid-back taxi driver?
Oh, I would have been taxi driving at the point when... at the point that Tim moved to Canterbury, funny enough.
Oh, well, yeah. It might not be good listening, but I used taxis a lot. We probably did.
We probably did. Longport taxi.
Probably taxis.
Can't go south of the Medway at this time of night. Is it the Medway?
The Medway is about,
it's not really in Canterbury. It'd be a bit further out, but...
Here we are, podcast 64. Good God, to the day exactly 6 years ago.
Oh, really?
September 2016. The only note that it says in the records is, a cupboard in Canterbury.
A very secret cupboard in Canterbury.
Oh, this must have been when you and Alan, were in your early days, were talking about how you got into Doctor Who.
Yeah, that's right.
Mark's introduction to fandom, long leaked traffic. Mm. Mark's mum burns his Findus crispy pancakes. That's because you took a long time to get home, walk home from Longleat, wasn't it?
Yeah, but that wasn't even the Doctor Who thing. That was just me. Oh, well, that was me visiting the Doctor Who exhibition. on foot from my house in Wiltshire at the time, yeah.
On Canterbury High Street, there is a shop. It's a record shop, you know, sells retro vinyls.
Oh, is the one that has a lot of strong incense?
Well, I've never been in.
No, okay. Well, sometimes you can tell just by walking past.
But above, and it's been there for ages, and somebody else pointed it out on Twitter, and I went and looked. There is a Peter Davison mannequin.
Oh.
In the cricket coat.
Yeah.
Looking down over the high street.
Okay, well, I can explain that.
Oh, did you put it there?
No, it wasn't me. No, but that used to be a comic shop, and it used to do comics and fan stuff, and they did used to sell those cardboard cutout things, and they used to sell loads of, you know, genre T-shirts, you know, from films and sci-fi stuff and fantasy stuff. Yeah, that's what used to be in the shop. For a long time, you could still buy, I don't know if you can still get comics and graphic novels and stuff in there, but they still had a wall of those in there because obviously they must have had some stock.
So there you go. Peter Davison is the guardian of Canterbury High Street. Mm. He overlooks it.
What was your favourite bookshop in Canterbury called, Mark? It was called The One or something.
No, it wasn't a bookshop. It was a, it did sell books, but it sold the videos as well. So I got my VHSs of Doctor Who from. It was Volume 1.
Oh, was it sort of like HMV sort of content?
Yeah, kind of, that kind of thing, yeah.
Where was that?
That was, it is now, I think it's Super Dry.
Which is now no longer Super, oh, I know what you mean, yeah.
It used to be next to...
It was FOP for a while, that, on St. Margaret Street.
Yeah, opposite the chip shop.
Yeah.
I've probably got about, whenever I go home to Manchester to see my mum in my old bedroom, there's probably might be perhaps two or three old Target novelizations. They've all gone now, as a lot of them did when I came home from university one week to find that my mum and dad had had a clear out. And so, well, we can send these to a charity shop, can't we? We won't ask Doc. Or Doctor. Doctor is my mother calls me, of course. I do remember that these three, they're more like the ones that you think of as actually being more like novels.
They are.
Than,
yeah,
should we say, novelizations, which is a polite way of saying effectively. At one point, it was effectively really just turning the script into prose, wasn't it?
Absolutely,
with some,
yeah,
of them. And again, those tended to be the very thin books, whereas the ones that were like novels were quite fat, and it wasn't that easy to get through a lot of them.
Yeah, well, these were written before a conscious effort to sort of merchandise,
yes, to market
everything.
It.
They're more written as an opportunity, presumably purchased by Muller, to make a few bob, but it's not a BBC-led drive, no, to cash in. So they're very carefully written as books. I get that sense, that they're carefully written as books to be books rather than trying to represent what would go on in the decades ahead, just trying to sort of catalogue everything in a book. And they're joyful for that. And they're naive and they're brilliant. And I confess, I haven't read a Target novel for years apart from these three because they're more interesting for that.
I don't think we can focus much on Bill Strutton, given that apart from this, he disappears, isn't he? Other than that, I think he was an Australian screenwriter, and he used to write quite heavily for shows like The Saint and The Avengers and Ivanhoe. Died on the 40th anniversary of Doctor Who Day. But given that the other two are both written by David Whittaker, I've always found it interesting that for the first script editor, he was so much involved in writing stuff for Doctor Who, he gets so little, comparatively so little, talked about, does he? I mean, perhaps if he'd been savvy enough to become the most undogmatic member of the Communist Party of Great Britain, he would have ended up with a bigger media profile.
Well, the thing about Whittaker is it was a huge success, and people don't fancy talking much about season one much because it's just this huge success. There's not a lot to say. By the time you get onto Donald Tosh, I mean, mm-hmm, you could talk for hours about all the bull that he talked about.
Mm.
So, yeah, he's an unsung hero. But it's good to see that on the forthcoming Blu-ray set, there's a feature about him.
Oh, the season 2 one?
On the season 2 one, yeah. And Simon Guerrier has been asking for information about David Whisker, so there may be something forthcoming there. But yeah, he is undersung.
He must have got on well with Terra Nation, mustn't he? Because he wrote so much Dalek-related stuff. I mean, he...
Yeah.
He wrote the Dalek strip in TV Century 21, didn't he? The Curse of the Dalek stage play. And those three books, which I've always wanted to own, but on eBay they've always been bloody hell. I'd have to stop eating for the rest of the month if I wanted to buy those, which are what? The Dalek World, the Dalek Book, and the Dalek Outer Space Book. The only content I'm really interested in is I adore the sort of art that was going on at that time. That would have been, what, 60s, would it? Mid to late 60s, wasn't it? Glorious sort of art. Very much, very similar, I think, to the TV Century 1 art. Maybe just because it's in colour, but I'd never looked at it. I'd have to look into that, whether they were the same artists who did it. It's unusual. You're saying you're getting up to 700 books because you weren't just buying... I'll get the whole run of them. It was every imprint.
Every imprint. And every, so you have the editions, as I think of them, with the different covers. And then you'd have imprints. So I think Day of the Daleks was the biggest, with maybe 8 or 9 different printings of it. And it was just the completest thing. It just got to my brain for a while.
Different colours of logos and things as well, wasn't there? A lot of...
Yeah, the logos changed, didn't they, and so on. And then the other thing that happened is they'd get a stock of books that they hadn't shifted. They'd be in a warehouse somewhere, and they'd rip the covers off them and slap a new cover on them. So you know those blue spines, the Virgin blue spines that came out in the 90s with the McCoy logo? Oh. Many of those were, in fact... They just had the cover ripped off them and a new cover slapped on from the later mid-80s. Print. So if you've got a blue spine Crotons, that would definitely originally have been one of the original target range books. So it just became interesting in itself, trying to piece together the print runs and so on.
Does the act of collecting eventually become a bit more important than what you're actually collecting?
Absolutely.
Because I imagine that, say, 80% of the books you didn't read.
I didn't read any of them. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And that's the thing with collecting, isn't it? You just become involved in the collecting of it. I really hadn't read, apart from revisiting to read the odd thing for the podcast, or for pleasure reading these Mullers. I bought all these books and didn't read a single damn one of them because I'd read them back in the 80s. Collectors are strange.
Did you go for anything other than the novelizations? Your... going for Doctor Who books extend any further than that?
Well, back in 1989-1990, I bought and read the first few New Adventures. I didn't go beyond that, but I did start collecting those. I went into all the Hainings and, you know, a celebration. And
yeah, and 25 Glorious Years, etc., yeah.
I got all of those. I got both editions of anything that was either W.H. Allen or Tom, all the same publishing house. Mm. I got, so I had two copies of the cookbook, one in paperback, one in hardback. I did read that, funnily enough. But yeah, I was just bitten by the bug, and it just became too much, and so I flogged a lot of them. The paperbacks wholesale... You can buy them for about £1 each, and I sold them for about £1 each. The hardbacks, though, they're really hard to find in non-ex-library condition, especially the ones with the dust jackets. They're really hard to find, and I've got some very, very lucky eBay house clearance stuff, where I bought, for instance, bought a non-library, pretty mint Dalek Invasion of Earth W.H. Allen hardback, non-library, and I bought it for £3, and I sold it for £1,200.
No!
Oh!
Hayden, how much did you pay for that book that you've the ones you've got? Wasn't £1,200 by any chance, was it?
Do you know what? It was somewhere between about £1,100 and £1,300, I think.
That was bought. It was actually bought. It was so scarce, word got about, and it was bought by someone who works on the show.
Oh. No.
And, you know, like a pyramids of Mars. I'm not showing, I'm just giving a feel. I'm not showing off. I'm just giving a feel for the scarcity of these things and how addictive the collecting comes.
No, it's interesting.
The showing off stopped when you got to about 700, Tim, at which stage we started thinking, how sad. I'm only joking.
It was sad. There were piles of Target books. This is only a flat. There were piles of Target books everywhere. And, you know, it just got too much. So you make the difficult decision to sell, knowing that some of these books you will never, ever, ever own again. I imported a Tales of Weng Chiang paperback. And it was the sixth printing or something. And I paid about 30 quid for it to get sent from Australia.
This is truly obsessive.
Because it was one that wasn't known about in the small collective of fans that were looking at these things and logging it and writing it down, how many printings there are. And yeah, it got out of hand.
It's not this one, is it? Hang on. I've got a weird one. Hang on a second.
Oh, Mark and I can confirm that. I was talking about books.
I'll tell you what, the straw that broke the camel's back was when someone got a printing that I didn't know about.
Oh, right.
And I thought, well, we're trying to log this stuff, and if there's just going to be an infinite number of re-jackets, I'll just throw in the towel.
Right. Yeah.
It's not that one, is it?
No, they're the American ones.
Oh, okay. It's a shame. I could have got rid of that.
Aidan's showing the... what's the publisher called?
Pinnacle.
Pinnacle Books, yeah.
Has that got yellow pages or white pages?
I mean, pretty yellow now, to be fair.
If you look at the edge of the book, is it yellow or is it white? It's white, then. If you can't tell, it's yellow. So, yeah, there were two runs of those, at least two runs of those. One with yellow edges and one with white edges.
Yeah,
so you
can white edges.
Yeah, so you can just go into detail after detail after detail. And then the crazy thing is, you can go on online, and there are people there who know word counts.
I've heard
of
this.
Books and stuff.
You know what? I'm a sucker for that.
And how many were printed originally and so on and so forth.
I follow Ben Aronovich on Twitter purely for his word count when he's doing his Rivers of London books, because it then it's an impetus for me to then write as well. But I'm a sucker for word counts.
But can Ben Aronovich tell you which Fourth Doctor book is the highest word count?
Oh,
probably not. No. So there are people who are into this more than I was, and it became unhealthy after a while.
Fourth Doctor. That wasn't the Key to Time season omnibus, was it?
No. No.
It's not the Loch Ness Monster, is it?
I wouldn't know, to be honest.
Oh, okay, right.
Well, The Power of the Daleks and the Evil of the Daleks, the John Peel ones, which were right at the end, they'd be the longest, wouldn't they, because they're chunky. And Robots of Death would be the shortest.
Yeah, that's paper thin. I've got that up there now.
There was a charity shop in Herne Bay, which is nearby to where me and Tim live, actually. And that was around the time of one of their Sci-Fi by the Sea mini conventions, which are no more. One of the local charity shops had an absolutely massive stock of the hardback novelizations in, not the ones with the dust covers, the ones with
the laminates, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely tons of them.
Were these first three titles the only ones that were hardbacked?
No, they were all hardbacks, all the way up to...
Really? I didn't know that.
The end.
Mm.
They were primarily done for libraries. It's a non-library copy.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense, of course, yeah.
When I used to go into the Bookworm in Clacton, which was where my granddad used to be opposite my granddad's bookies, he used to give me 50p and say, go buy some books, and the Doctor Who Target books were always in there for about 10p. And now I've learnt the value of these things. I really wish I hadn't turned these down, but I used to go for the paperbacks because they were easier to hold and easier to read, but there were lots of these hardbacks there. Lots of hardbacks. I remember a fairly chunky Peter Davison one where I think it was... Oh, no, it would have been Ark of Infinity would have been there. There was... I remember seeing an Ark of Infinity one, and it was literally the front cover was just Michael Goff holding a gun to Peter Davison. They're both standing like that, sort of like side on side. And there's like this yellow, sort of like mustardy yellow sort of colour.
Yeah.
And it was crap. And I was like, I'm not buying this. I'd rather buy a paperback instead of one of these hardbacks. And I never bought a hardback. The only hardback Doctor Who book I actually have. No, I haven't got any Doctor Who hardbacks. I always wait for the paperback. I've got The Vault and The Hooniverse and The Women Who Lived. They're the only... Well, and obviously the 60s, 70s and 80s books, but they're, you know, that's non-fiction.
So if... I suppose we've better start separating the sheep from the goats, the men from the boys. 700-odd sounds very impressive, Tim, but did you ever get hold of the Marks and Spencer's edition of Doctor Who and the Daleks Omnibus?
Of course.
Oh, wow. What a man.
Of course I did. And the...
Artist
and
was
the,
that
oh, gosh, yeah. I can't remember what it was now, but there was a T.
Yes.
Is it PG Tips?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
No, Typhoo. The Amazing World of Doctor Who.
Typhoo.
I got that out earlier today, so when I said that grey cover of Amazing Adventure of the Daleks looked like... I said, is that... Does that remind me of... Because I seem to remember that the... Shall we say that the... Getting on for the lousiest artwork appeared in that one. Was that one where they've got a picture of the Fourth Doctor, Sarah and Harry, and they don't look anything like them?
Yeah, but that's because they're taken from the annuals, aren't they? That artwork.
In fact, Harry had a moustache.
They weren't allowed to use the... likenesses of the... They only had the rights to use the likeness of the Doctor, didn't they? So they couldn't use the likenesses of the companions. So that's why the companions don't ever really appear in a satisfactory form in those early annuals.
I was just going to say, all this talk about books, I'm feeling so warm and cosy and comfortable right now. I've got a glow about me.
There were two, or maybe three books I never got that I was after before I threw the towel in. I could have persevered. But before I sold out, the ones I didn't get were... There was an annual called The Invasion from Space, William Hartnell. I didn't bother with the Dalek ones, but that was on my list. Doctor Who, The Invasion from Space. And it would have been like the third annual, in effect. But it was a novel in annual-sized hardback form. And then it was a hardback of The Wheel in Space that I didn't get my hands on. Everyone says the paperback is rare. And there's myths about a warehouse burning down. But that, in book collecting terms, warehouses burning down is an explanation for everything. And it's all from the Second World War. And The Wheeling Space isn't rare at all. If you want to try and find a rare book, look it up on eBay. And if it's not there, it's not there. You know, it's rare. Mm. There is never not a copy of The Wheeling Space in paperback on eBay for 30 quid. It's just someone set a market value at 30 quid. I mean, I had four or five of them at one time, just buying collections. You know what I mean? So, yeah, The Wheel in Space in hardback and The Invasion from Space were two on my list that I never managed to get a hold of, and a Muller Daleks with a pink dust jacket. I've got a first edition Muller Daleks there, and it's lovely. It's just waiting for the dust jacket. So all donations to the Who's Ian.
The Invasion from Space book, I remember around the time when I was trying to complete my annuals collection, was about £650 on eBay. And I have to admit, and this was about 6 years ago, I have never seen it come up again since. So you're absolutely right.
Yeah. You see absolutely battered ones with the spine missing and doodled in for maybe £150 or something like that. But yeah.
Wow.
Oh, I didn't get the pink Pertwee annual either. That's the other one I didn't get. Have you got that?
I have, yeah. That pink annual is the most I have ever spent on any form of memorabilia ever to do with anything. It was about £250.
Wow, yeah, that's what it goes for. Yeah.
Yeah. And on the same day, I bought the Troughton, the second Troughton one with the Cyberman and Jamie on the front.
Yeah.
And my eBay payout was about £400.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah.
Did you have any special memories of any particular bookshop you went for these Target books when you were a kid, Mark?
No. Most of my Target reading actually would have been library books. I had a few. I can't even remember where we got them from. I think I might have picked up quite a few old Doctor Who annuals and books from school fairs, which they used to have.
Oh, right, yes.
You know, just be like a...
Like a bring and buy.
Yeah, well, like, kind of like a boot fair, but in a less cars, and it's in classrooms in a school. And yeah, just tables full of old stuff like that. I got used to get loads of old Blue Peter annuals and things like from there. I don't think I bought any of my Doctor Who Target novels new.
You didn't buy them, you just didn't return them to the library.
No. That would be the other person on the podcast. Yes. Who isn't Tim? No, it's... most of my Target reading was done with the big hardbacks that I got out from the local library when I lived in Warminster, I think, in Wiltshire.
I can tell you that I can remember going to Bolton Library, that's where I'm from, with my parents or my grandparents, and they'd always have, well, not always, but sometimes have hardback novels, ex-library, with a big 10p written on the inside, and we bought a load of them. And I'm ashamed to say that these came down in boxes when I moved to Canterbury in 2001, and I binned them.
No.
And Tomb of the Cybermen was one of them. Even in ex-library now, that can go for between 50 and 100. But you know.
But you weren't to know.
I wasn't to know, and that's the price that's the price you pay for being cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Speaking about the price you pay for being cool.
Oh.
There you go.
Oh, Hayden is showing a very nice 1970 pink Pertwee annual.
And it hasn't been written in, look. Look at that.
Is it? It's not clipped as well.
It's not clipped, no.
Oh,
it's pristine. Gosh. It's got no... I don't think anyone's tried doing the puzzles in here, actually.
None of them are as good as the Terry Nation Dalek annuals.
Oh, that smell.
That's someone else's dead skin. Oh, that's amazing. Non-clipped and without the crosswords done.
Well, let's just hope three pages don't fall out when he's showing it off again.
Oh, God, can you imagine?
That's the daddy of annuals, that one, yeah.
Well, because it's rarity.
Yeah.
Ooh. What's going on with Liz Shaw in this picture?
Ooh. Well, she scraped her hair back, isn't she?
Ooh.
Sorry, I'm going to put on the collar, look at that. In the mind extractors.
Right, so we will put these books in the library section of the exhibition hall. Thank you, Tim.
And Hayden's tagged, isn't he? So if he goes anywhere near the library section, the alarm goes off.
I think it's only fair that Hayden's incredibly rare Pertwee annual goes in there for safekeeping, to be honest.
Well, it's in a special case to stop Mark and Doc from devaluing it by doing the crosswords. Or clipping the price out as well.
Oh, I used to get really annoyed. My parents used to do that at Christmas. They give me an annual and they clip the price out.
Yeah.
I don't know why I used to get annoyed, because I never used to think, oh no, I want to keep this so I can sell it for thousands and years to go.
Did you used to get annoyed when they used to write, "To Doc, love from Mum and Dad"? Christmas 1975. He's like, oh, how dare you? Stop ruining my books, damn you.
My parents used to do that. And I got to a point when I moved in with my wife, when we moved house, I got rid of a lot of old books. You know, books that don't have it, like Terry Venables' all-time England team, that kind of thing. But they all said like, Christmas 1996, to Hayden, lots of love, Mum and Dad. And my mum came across one in a charity shop recently and went,
oh,
well, look what I came across.
It would have been interesting if you'd kept collecting those, Hayden, and then perhaps you'd have been saying to us this week, well, I was in a bookshop today and I saw they've just brought out some Gareth Southgate's all-time England team and I've decided to stop collecting them. Tim, what's the next thing?
Can I go for a wee?
Oh, yes, of course you can.
Yeah, it's just down there on the left.
It's just behind the Gary Downey and JNT mosaic. And then...
Good, I'll be back in a minute.
Okay. No,
I'm going to go as well, actually.
He'll give me a chance to kick back and read this.
Morning, gents. Like a nice wash, would you? Shall we go to my little room?
Ooh. Now then, you know how some of the drawings are a little bit,
crappy?
Suspect. That's the Brigadier. It looks like Gene Hackman in a false moustache. But yeah, look at this. Look, none of them have been done. I completely forgot about this.
Oh, yeah, so you'll go in, you'll find that someone's gone into the spot the differences and circled all the... Yeah.
I mean, look at this guy. What's his problem?
Who is that?
I don't think it's Sergeant Benton, I think.
Hey! Quite while he's... Oh, damn. He's back. We couldn't just reach in and snatch the Yetis.
Are you lot all wee-shaming me by not going for a wee at the same time?
We have perfect bladder control.
Have you noticed how the Brigadier looks like Gene Hackman wearing a false moustache in these
amazing scenes?
That's incredible. It's like the Poseidon Adventure, but it's on dry land.
Hello.
Hello.
Pertwee. Ooh, the Pertwee drawings, I was about to say, look really good, but apart from this one, which looks like Herman Munster.
Oh my God, what's he doing?
Is he crouched on a tree branch or something? Tim, what's the next thing that you brought to the museum for us? What are these large, almost man-sized glass tubes you brought with you?
Well, Doc, those glass tubes...
What's the frantic hammering I can hear from inside them?
So, I was briefed when I was coming to donate to the museum that I could bring anything.
Mm.
And even though I don't strictly own these things, I thought I would donate their future selves. So that one day if they ever stumble into the museum, they may look upon these glass cases with themselves in there and wonder what the heck is going on. Maybe they've jumped a time track or something. So, I'm donating to the museum, and they can thank me later, the missing episodes researchers of Team New Zealand.
Aha!
Namely, and there may be others, but these are the four flag bearers, as far as I'm concerned and aware, and apologies to anyone who is missing out here, but gentlemen by the name of Graham Howard, Paul Schoons, Neil Lambus, and John Preddle.
If there are any others, they're all hiding now because they ought to end up having the same fate.
Well, I've basically accounted for at least 20% of the population of New Zealand now, so we've got some pretty good coverage. But the reason...
But what's it for?
Well, this may come as a surprise to you, but I'm a missing episodes nerd.
No.
You know I am.
I am. Yeah, I do a podcast about it and everything. And what Team New Zealand bring to the history of the missing episodes is brilliant. A story of near misses, a story of thorough research, a story of sharing their research and their story, and some successes as well. So, shall I rattle through these four?
Please do.
And tell you why I'm donating them to the museum. Because, you know, they're not Ian Levine's. They're not Philip Morris's.
That's the whole reason, isn't it?
Maybe. But they are remarkable people. So, there's a guy called Graham Howard, who I've never spoken to. And Graham Howard is the guy who investigated the NZBC a couple of decades ago. And he was knocking on the door for a year trying to get in there. And eventually, after a year, they let him into their film store. And imagine him trepidatiously exploring their film store and getting to the bit where the guy says, "There's the Doctor Who." And he goes and finds two film cans. One has a label on it that says, "The Assassin at Peking." And the other one has a label on it that says, "The Moonbase Episode 3. Can you imagine how exciting it was?
Mm.
And then he opens them up and they've got different films in.
Oh, God.
So there are two very well-known, I don't know if that's how it came about, but there are two well-known photographs of film cans with Assassin at Peking and the Moonbase on there, and they had their own film cans in. But Graham Howard also successfully found, in a private collection, he also found sensor clips. So it's not just Damien Shanahan and his Australian sensor clips that are well known. Graham Howard found sensor clips on a reel in a private collection from the Web of Fear, before the Web of Fear was back, and 1 7-second clip of the Wheel in Space episode 5. So that's often forgotten, and Team New Zealand found stuff there, and that's great. But Graham Howard also, so when you're looking at missing episodes and trying to figure out where you might find some, because BBC Enterprises made copies onto 16mm and sent them all over the world, there is very, very little paperwork that exists about who sent what to whom. So latterly, and you know, in the last couple of decades, they found the sales top sheets that say in each story's file, there's a sheet that says this was sold to ABCXYZ.
ABCXYZ. Has anyone tried contacting that television channel to see if they have any missing episodes?
Yeah.
But you don't know how the film reroutes happened. And Graham Howard, I believe it's Graham Howard, apologies to Team New Zealand if it wasn't Graham Howard, but he got hold of the shipping logs. So they know precisely whether New Zealand films were sent overseas or junked, apart from a couple of instances, which I'll get on to. And nobody talks about this. Nobody talks about this at all. Everyone's always banging on about Phil Morris and Ian Levine. And nobody mentions poor old Graham Howard. Bless him. He's only one of four. Let's move on. So Graham Howard is in the first case there, looking hard done by. In the second and third cases are gentlemen by the names of Paul Schoons and Neil Lambus. And Neil Lambus, who I first happened upon because he was obsessed with an idea that a school in New Zealand, I think his school, when he was at school, showed an episode of the Macro Terror. And he did this full investigation, trying to piece together whether it happened, whether there would have been films there, and so on. And this was on the Missing Episodes Forum back in about 2010, and you can still read it now. But Neil Lambus got wind that a collector by the name of Bruce Grenville might have a missing episode. And to cut a long story short, he got hold of his friend Paul Schoons, a name that everyone will be familiar with. And they made contact with this collector and went round to the collector's house and had to sit through this film collector showing a film called Veronica Voss while they're waiting to get the missing Doctor Who on, and lo and behold, they're sat there, and episode one, The Lion of the Crusade, was shown. And then Paul Schoons, after he's got over the shock, starts trying to repatriate this with the BBC, and he gets all this of Steve Roberts, and Julie sends off the film, and we've got a missing episode back. So that's brilliant, and that's remarkable, and it's a story of chance. But the best thing about this story is they don't stop there, Team New Zealand. They then start trying to trace back the root of this film, and how could it have ended up in the hands of Bruce Grenville, who then tried to sell it for £1 million or something and got naff all. They then investigate, and they followed it back, not only from Bruce Grenville, but to another source and to another place where it was sat with a load of other films. And they managed to trace it back to, get this, the van that would visit the tip in Wellington, that would, the guy who would go and hand cherry pick out films, and then, you know, they'd get passed on. They even, as part of their investigation, this tip, this dump that was filled in, they've even been and stood on the football pitch that now stands on top of the dump, trying to work out precisely what happened. And just as a sidebar there, they've also worked out through shipping logs and through getting to grips with what NZBC had, that most of the films in that block of sales were sent off to Singapore. And it just so happens that The Crusade and one or two others may not have been. But what are the chances of a missing episode turning up in that New Zealand never showed The Crusade, and they also never showed the Dalek invasion of Earth, and they also never showed the Web Planet. And so presumably all of those films were tipped into this dump, or dumped into this tip, and they managed to, the one thing that survived is a missing episode of this splendid serial. So I think that's brilliant, and I've got goosebumps talking about it.
Mm, I know you have a great conversation with Paul Scoones on your podcast about it, don't you?
Yeah.
And it's great. I think the detail from that I particularly like is the letter that I think Richard received from Alvin.
This was Neil. Neil received.
Oh, sorry. The letter which Neil received from Alvin Rakoff, which Jacqueline Hill's husband.
Oh, yes.
That was...
It's goosebumps, isn't it? It's the most amazing thing I've heard as a Doctor Who fan, frankly.
Yeah, it basically thanks him, doesn't it, for finding the episode and just giving him a piece of his wife's work life back to him and stuff. And it's,
I think he worded it more powerfully than that.
Oh, yes, like, yeah, absolutely.
Giving me a piece of Jacqueline back.
Mm.
Yeah, goosebumps.
Mm.
And, you know, all of this has happened, and I'll get on to the fourth in a moment, but all of this has happened in an unassuming way. They just get on, they deal with it, they publish all their research, it's all just there. And, you know, it's not umpteen missing episodes, but it's remarkable. And not to throw shade on other people, but it's just done in this unassuming, brilliant, for-the-cause sort of way, and it's thorough. And it involves going back to source and finding the original notes and sharing them and talking about it and adding to the greater understanding of what's gone on. I mean, it may sound dry as toast to say that somebody found the shipping logs, the film traffic notes from New Zealand, but so little of this exists that knowing that a country who bought almost everything has sent things off to ABCXYZ, opens up a world of possibilities into research. Oh. And not to throw shade on anyone, but people who say they've been to places and they've got traffic logs of things and they're not sharing that and they're not revealing the fruits of their labours.
Yes.
Then shame on them, because other people can pick up the baton. Absolutely. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
This ABCXYZ channel has got its fingers in a lot of pies, hasn't it? Yes. I thought it was a little cruel of the BBC to write to Alvin Rakoff when they heard about this letter saying, you may have recovered a bit of your wife, but please remember that we hold the copyright to her.
Yeah, an episode that will live in infamy. Can I get on with number four? The fourth person in the glass tube is John Preddle, who is a name who you may have heard of. And John Preddle runs a website called Broadcast with a DW in the middle. And what John has done is he's travelled the world looking at newspaper cuttings or newspapers from around the world. So he's been to the US, he's been to the British Library, and he sits there poring over newspapers trying to work out if any TV stations in the world showed Doctor Who. And so there is a BBC record that shows that, I don't know, example off the top of my head, that Nigeria showed Marco Polo, which it did. But it doesn't say which station out of the nine in Nigeria showed Marco Polo. So imagine every story, every permutation and combination that this brings, every black and white story, and every country that bought Doctor Who. And John has been sat there in the British Library or wherever, poring through newspapers, trying to find mentions of Doctor Who, or Children's Hour, or Son of Doctor Who, or whatever they called it in these overseas countries. And he's gathered all this data, and he's put it into spreadsheets. And it's all there for everyone to see. So those who are interested in the fate of missing episodes can go for free to Broadcast and see where exactly in the world, as far as he can tell from his inaccurate newspaper cuttings from Sierra Leone today, what was shown where. And this is done in an unassuming way, at his own expense, and published for the world to see. And he's forever updating it, forever rehashing his theories. And therefore, that's why I'm donating to the Whoseum, the future selves of Team New Zealand, because they are awesome. They are brilliant people.
And I think the thing that, one of the things that sort of I suspect this is treachery, you most of them, is what you just said. Unassuming.
Yeah.
No one says, do they? Well, there's this guy called Leon Levine. I don't know if you've heard of him. You know what I mean? Their method is different to Phil Morris's and Ian Levine's, isn't it? I mean, I don't think we should entirely diss Phil Morris and Ian Levine, because Phil Morris made one of their most remarkably memorable contributions to the anniversary year with those two stories. Enemy, a story that was so lost, this has always been forgotten. My big surprise was how much better I thought Enemy was than Webb.
Oh, take that back, Doc. Take that back.
I agree with you, Doc.
No.
Yeah, sorry.
But Fear's my childhood favourite.
But you can achieve things without, should we say, without being a dick about it?
Without making it about yourself.
Well, here's the thing, though. Enemy and Webb were found, and Phil Morris has told the story of how he's been top to bottom in Nigeria. And he said he's been to Sierra Leone and he's got the film traffic logs that show that all of Doctor Who was sent back to the UK in 1974. But he's not said anything for 10 years about his research, what's been ruled out, what's been ruled in. There's been no further discussion since 2013 about anything. And I just think, well, Phil Morris isn't going to live forever. I hope he does. But he's not going to live forever, and he needs to start passing on this information to researchers who can log it, who can write about it, who can do whatever, because in 20 years, or 30 years, or 40 years, people are going to start looking again. And, you know, the story isn't told.
I always liken, I mean, when you said about, you know, the New Zealand method of looking for missing episodes and for information, it seems to me that it sort of followed that. I'm always reminded of that Francis Watson story, you know, the man who had Day of Armageddon, the second episode of Dalek's Master Plan. One day just came across two cans that were they sitting in his house somewhere? And he went, oh, these are both Doctor Who. I bet someone's looking for these. And I think within like a few days, I would think one of them was episode 5 of the Daleks. And I mean, you'll be able to tell me better than anyone, Tim, really. But I think one of them was episode 5 of the Daleks, so that was something which we already had. And then Day of Armageddon was then. I think Steve Bryant heard about it. And then by that afternoon that he'd heard that the episodes were back, it was up on the BBC website. Just, here you are. Here's the thing back. But it just seems to me that since the introduction of Philip Morris into this tale of Doctor Who missing episodes, it's all very cloak and dagger, and it's all very secret squirrel. And it's needlessly like that. Yes. And I think the problem for me is that he seems to have wanted the celebrity of it too much. You know, I mean, that moment of him on the One Show, dressed up and in an Indiana Jones costume with a film can under his arm, to me, is just as embarrassing as a Doctor Who fan as Doctor in Distress. Because, you know, you don't want someone who's perpetuating that idea that Doctor Who fans are a bit odd, you know, and yet there's one there on the telly trying to, like, create his own legend, as it were, and trying to be like, yes, I'm like Indiana Jones. In fact, I will quote that in Doctor Who magazine. People say I'm the Indiana Jones. Well, no, Phil, only you do, clearly. And winding up fans online.
We do say, more to keep us going than anything, that if we ever decide, right, this is our very final podcast, we'll just open up the vault on my hard drive and just take out all the censored clips. broadcast it and then run for their lives.
Don't. I wonder if the New Zealand team are going to discover our censored clips one day.
But I was listening this afternoon to your podcast. So we'll put links of this, of course, everything on our show notes at diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com, of course, listeners, to your interview with Paul Scoones. And I thought it was interesting that he said, he was emphasising, you know, it was Neil that found it. He said, essentially the story is, Neil found it, I returned it. Compared to an online slanging match between other people, which goes on for years.
Yeah. It's a grown-up and professional way of dealing with it, which doesn't happen with the other two, you know.
Back in our podcast 40... in 2015, when Hayden did a long interview with Kevin Davis of 30 Years in the TARDIS fame, he told us the story of when he and... Was it Paul Venezia or someone discovered the 6 seconds of clips from Power of the Daleks while they were having breakfast?
Was that... That might have been Andrew Pixley, I think.
That, it might have been, yes. Pixley, they were, they'd been given some film clips and said, oh, just have, you can have these if you want. And they were watching them on a little TV while they're having the breakfast, and suddenly the missing clips from Power of the Daleks came up, and they decided, let's phone Ian Levine and tell him. And I think apparently Ian was... Ian refused to believe them for a while, didn't he? Well, let's see if we can find that somewhere.
He kept telling them to wind it back. He was like, show that again. Show that again. That kind of thing, yeah.
Previously... On Diddlydum.
This is what fans do. You get a lead and you become like an amateur detective. It's what they're doing with the missing episodes. You know, follows a lead and asks someone else.
Yeah.
And a totally random connection suddenly produces some gold.
Mm.
The funniest moment probably was we'd done the interview, I think, with Delia Derbyshire, and Brian Hodgson gave us a bunch of tapes. He said, oh, you might find some bits on there. It's worth having a look. Unfortunately, the master tape of this showreel of radiophonic workshop stuff was pinched by someone who left the BBC. They took it with them. Think we know who's got it, but we can't prove it, and they've gone.
Oh.
But got these VHS, time-coded VHSs. And he gave them to me and said, here you go, for your project. So we took them home with us, and Andrew Pixley was staying in London because he came down from Nottingham and he stayed with me several times during the project. And we were due, I think, to go and possibly go and do the shoot with Sylvester, I'm not sure, something like that. And so we got up really early that morning. And we said, oh, well, while we're having a, you know, bowl of cornflakes or whatever, let's shove on a couple of these tapes and see what's on there. And I remember Andrew going, huh, do you know what's going to happen? Any moment now, there'll be a clip of some seaweed monsters or something, you know. So it's a throwaway comment. And within moments, there was that 6-second clip of Power of the Daleks. And we kind of,
Of the Daleks blowing up.
It was so uncanny. We laughed and played it back immediately. So by the time we then got to doing the shoot with Ian Levine in studio with the Emperor Dalek, you know, we sat Ian down in front of the Emperor Dalek and did an interview with him. We didn't let on, but we had a playback unit there specially to show him this clip. So we want to show you something. He was so suspicious. I've got the footage still. We didn't use it in the program in the end, but I did it in case, because we thought he was going to explode or something, you know. And he said, he just watched it through silently and went, play it again. Play it again. I think he thought we were tricking him, that we'd faked it somehow.
Yeah.
And he's going, I don't quite believe what I'm seeing. I said, well, no, it's real. It's real. He said, are you sure? I think he was so suspicious that we were trying to have him on. I said, no, we just wanted to get your reaction when we show you a bit of Doctor Who you haven't seen before. You know, you haven't seen since it was first on.
Brilliant.
It's very hard to know with this stuff. Just going back to the research, sorry. We're not entitled.
No.
It's not in the public domain. It doesn't belong in a museum. But I can still go on to John Preddle's website and see what the latest research is and what's been shown. And you know, there was a book called Wipes that had two editions.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Molesworth, yeah.
And, you know, that's not been updated since 2013. And it's sort of frustrating on a personal front. Also, you could go on the Missing Episodes forum in 2010, 2009, 2011. Mm. And see the state of the search. And then since 2013, there's been no Wiped, there's been no Missing Episodes Forum updates. And, you know, you've got a taste for it then. And I'm trying to piece together where things might have gone. And there's just been zilch. And so I hope, selfishly, and I'm not entitled to it, but I just hope one day that the story will be told, because, like collecting earlier, the collecting becomes the addiction rather than the material. You sort of get hooked into the story of where these films went and what happened to them and which archives burnt down and all the rest of it, and it just becomes interesting.
It's not really something you can just dip into, is it? Because, you know, if you just go on Gallifrey and say, oh, I'll have a look at the Missing Episodes forum or something, and you'll usually find someone who says, has anyone thought of ringing around TV stations in Africa and asking if they've got any? You know, someone, I don't mean foolishly, but someone who's clearly not looked into this before.
Mm. Well, have I ever spoken, I think I might have spoken to you in the past, Tim, about this, but how I...
It's like if you've ever been on a Christmas morning with young kids, so they're opening the presents under the tree, and it's like a flurry of paper going everywhere. And once the last present's been opened, but they're almost saying, oh, is that it? Because I remembered when, I mean, I was hugely excited when Webb and Enemy were revealed just before the 50th anniversary. And, you know, people were, was it a Thursday night? People were taking a Thursday off work. You want to download them off iTunes, and I did that.
Yeah.
First one that downloaded was the one episode of Web that wasn't found, so it was just the, you know, the recon. And, once downloaded fully, I went into it, so it was a recon. What, those lying bastards? All of it's a lie.
I can't tell you, that excitement, that day...
It was thrilling, wasn't it?
BBC News put an article up 2 days, I think, before the episodes were announced.
Yeah.
I remember where I was. I was in the Imperial War Museum, and I was just looking around London. That was because that evening I was going to an initiative that Gordon Roxburgh was trying to set up with regards to looking for missing material, and he'd invited me along, and it was at the BFI, and Dick was hosting it. So then that evening I was in the green room at the BFI, and we're all sitting around in a load of the chairs talking missing TV. And we all, I mean, even though that BBC article had come up, and there were, I can remember it so clearly, there was a picture of Patrick Troughton and Kevin Stoney playing Tobias Vaughan. And we're all saying, oh, I wonder what's back. Well, I wonder what's back. And one of the people in the room knew what was back and sort of whispered in Hushto's, Enemy and Web. You know, and I was like, so I knew 2 days before the rest of fandom, and I was exploding to sort of tell people. To the point that
did you tell us? I can't remember.
I didn't know you then. It was about 18 months
before. We hadn't started the podcast then.
Yeah, 18 months before the podcast.
It was about 3 months before we started the podcast. Hayden, if we'd known you then and you'd not told us for 48 hours, we would never have spoken to you again.
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, I hadn't signed an NFT, you know, whatever. It's, you know. But anyway, but I had a friend who was really into the missing, like the Omni rumor and all the rest of it. And he was one of the talking heads on the Czech Lies and Videotape documentary,
oh, right.
Which is probably one of the best documentaries, to be honest, on the on the range. And I didn't even tell him, and he must. I was just like, I don't want to say, because I thought, well, if I say something and it turns out to be wrong, or it's not an episode that we think it's going to be, or a story, you know, that I've been told, maybe, you know, if I'd have been told it was, I don't know, The Wheel in Space and Fury instead of Enemy and Web, then I'd have looked an idiot, and then so I just thought, no, I'll keep it shtum. But yeah, it was only like 2 or 3 years after, I think, the first time. I think when we were speaking about missing episodes on this podcast was when I came clean that actually someone told me at that event, which was just crazy. And being such a big Web of Fear fanboy as well, I was just like... But I never knew there was going to be one missing episode. I knew someone who was at the launch event, which they announced it and then embargoed it. Did they embargo it until the evening, I think? And I knew someone who was there, and I said, oh, what, all of it's back? And someone said, no, it's missing an episode.
Do you ever ask yourself, Hayden, in your more spiritual moments, whether that missing episode of Web, your favourite story, is God's punishment for you never returning that library book? But the point I was making about the children under the trees, oh, no presents left. So that we downloaded all those two stories on the Thursday, and within about a week, people were back on the forums saying stuff like, it's a scandal that I don't know, Morris won't release all his films of Magna Carta, of Marco Polo, because, you know, oh, there could be, you know, my granddad has only got a few weeks left to live. And it would so much, you know, that sort of emotional. And you're thinking, can't you just pause? And you know it's probably going to be a few years before anything comes back again. Just, you know, pause. And I think the fact that accepting that they're not all going to come back, it makes it so, I think it makes it almost more special to be a Doctor Who fan, because you'll never be able to be a completist. There's always...
I remember when Christopher Barry passed away. I don't know when that was, maybe 2014 or 2015 or something. Ian Levine was on Twitter saying, Christopher Barry will never get to see Power of the Dalek. I've taken that... So whenever any celebrity has died now in my various little WhatsApp groups and Facebook groups, the Queen won't get to see Power of the Daleks.
There was a rather churlish fan who I remember retweeted that saying, sadly, Christopher Barry never lived to read this tweet. And it was about like, oh, God. You know, people are just horrid. And Ian Levine's horrid.
Wasn't that the text of the formal notice they put on the railings of Buckingham Palace? The Queen died peacefully this afternoon, having never had a second chance to watch Marco Polo.
It was actually the list of missing episodes that Phil Morris claims to have in his Wigan lockup.
And so, oh, hang on, just a minute, I'm getting a message. Yes? Really? Oh, that's wonderful news. Yes, yes, I'll be sure to let them know. Thank you. Well, guys, it's official. There is now no one in New Zealand who hasn't been canonised. So then, we'll move our four new guests in their hermetically sealed tubes. We can't really criticise Phil Morris for dressing up as Indiana Jones, because I see that all these guys are dressed as hobbits. That's interesting, isn't it? We'll move them into our cryogenic display area, along with our only other live person so far, which is Joanna Lumley. That's been nice.
Oh,
Andrew Carmel donated her, I seem to remember. We allow her out weekends to film documentaries about Gurkhas.
Tim, what's your third and final thing you've brought us?
This may seem a bit out of left field, but it is the 2015 DVD release of The Underwater Menace. Mark, you seem to be wavering at my choice.
No, go on. I'm sure nothing in the world can stop you now, so off you go.
Well, look, I don't think anyone else has ever put a DVD in there, have they, from the range?
No, I'm thinking of donating my season 17 Blu-ray box set at some point, but I'll do that when Hayden's taking the tail.
Oh, you with your season 17. I know I'm sounding over familiar by this point, but I've heard all your podcasts, and because you're so good at sounding like a conversation you want to join in with, that's why I can exasperatedly say, you with your season 17.
Hey, that is not a Bolton accent.
So, I'm donating The Underwater Menace on DVD for a number of reasons, and I hope to generate some moments of reflection about a few things while people shuffle around the Hoosium and think, why the hell is that there? So it's the last of the range, as I think of it. And so it might cause a moment of reflection on that range was pretty damn good, wasn't it? Weren't we spoiled by a release every couple of months for years, and they all came with extras and restored, sometimes played with for better or worse. And so this is the end of that range. And so, yeah, I think some nod to the DVD range should go in there for all its strengths and weaknesses. I think if you're a Star Trek fan, you're green with envy.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. No, you've won me over already.
And this is the last one. And this
Yes.
This happened in 2015, October 2015, late 2015. And by my reckoning, I think before this were Enemy and Web in early 2014, because they were available online before that. And then goodness knows what it was before that, but I reckon it would have been 2013-ish, maybe early 2014.
I think it was Terror of the Zygons.
Yeah. Was that a special edition?
No, it was the first release of it.
Was it? Well, there you go. 2014, early 2014?
30th of September 2013 is when it came out.
Wow.
I'm sure I heard that they were planning to finish on that.
Yeah. Although we knew that Underwater Menace was in the pipeline, and there was this strange delay while it happened. And basically it got a late release because I think my understanding is they were trying to unpick the relationship with the production company at the time, Pup, Dan Hall. And I think an animation was originally planned and it didn't happen, and eventually they ended up doing the cheapest of recons. Now, yeah, it's a Telesnap recon that is okay for episode 1. Doesn't work so well with all the action for episode 4. And, John Kelly did it. No, John, just in defense of John, I met John at the BFI a few weeks ago, and John is a really fine multimedia producer, and he knows how to do a Telesnap recon. And this isn't from John, but this is my understanding from years ago, is that the instruction came through that they have to do the recon doing nothing but a progression of the teleslides with no mixing or anything. And so that's what was delivered. Although there is a sneaky TARDIS dissolve on there, which shouldn't have been on there.
Ah, so it's been a while since I've seen that DVD. I do have it. It's currently in storage with about 90% of the rest of my life. And just off the Thanet Way there, which Tim will like. I don't remember. So does the reconstruction go? Is there any timing done at all? It's not just like this picture for so many seconds. This picture, for the same.
It is timed. But a normal recon would use first of all, if you didn't have any other photographs, if you're doing a recon, you'd cut back and forth to show somebody talking, then somebody else talking, then else talking. There's none of that. They have to be, the rules were it has to be sequential, but obviously they can cut whenever they like. So it's poor compared to other recons, but that's just a symptom of the restrictions that were put on them when it had to be released. But hey, you know, it's got all of the bells and whistles, other stuff on there. It's got a making of. It's got commentaries on there. It's got a couple of three features on there, I think, which were all prepared back in 2013. And then they had this wrangling that they had to go through. But Doc was talking about, would we be sad if all the missing episodes came back? Because missing episodes, nuts like me, wouldn't have anything to talk about. But it just... I hope when people see this in the Hoosium, it will offer a pause for thought and reflection on the many, many different ways people have desperately tried to recreate missing episodes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would actually obviously be over the moon if every single missing episode came back. What I said is more a bit of a consolation. Yes, it may never happen, but the fact it's never going to happen is itself a bit of a consolation. Why did they insist on doing this with the telesnaps? Was it just for cost purposes?
I wouldn't like to speculate. But yes. Yes, I think there might have been some entanglements that needed disentangling. But it was cost purposes. Do it as cheap as possible and get it out there.
Yeah, I have to say, I think it was back in 2016. I had a back problem and I was pretty much laid up for months. And I watched all of the Hartnell and Troughton era from start to finish over the course of a few weeks. I watched all the recons that I could get my hands on. And certainly there's varying quality, isn't there? And some stories are suited to it far better. I mean, the massacre is so difficult because there's so much talking and there's so many characters. And it's hard to know who's saying what when you're watching the recon and who's saying it to who. That was the toughest one for me. I know that was a problem for you as well, wasn't it, Doc? Because your blog abruptly ends at the massacre that you were doing back then.
So I actually watched to the end of the Hartnell era, but I didn't put it on past the massacre. I just lost...
lost the will.
I just lost motivation at one point.
Yeah, it's quite a steep curve. I mean, obviously, Marco Polo would have been the first ones that I started watching. And at first I was like, oh, this is hard work. And then after a while, when you watch quite a lot of them in quick succession, your brain does start adapting and it kind of fills in gaps for you. And all these years later, I find I look back on that period when I watched all those missing episodes in a row and all the recons. And it's almost like my memory reports back to me that I saw them as moving pictures because I know what the actors look like in costumes. I've watched it. I've heard the dialogue and everything. And so my brain kind of seems to be almost filling it in.
Yeah. I mean, I think everyone has their own way of enjoying things, and I've gone through all of it, and the animations, by and large, some of which I enjoy, most of which I don't, just because I find them distracting.
Yes.
I just find myself listening to the narrated audios now. And if, for instance, there's a censor clip that exists, I mean, you could think of the Highlanders and think of it as some brilliant, epic sort of sets and... scenes, and there's always a temptation to imagine it bigger and better than it was. But if I've just got a censor clip or some photographs that I can look at, I can almost visualize how the whole thing would have looked. And I find myself now, like in preparation for my podcast, just listening to the narrated audio more often than not to get a sense of what's going on, because the animations are so distracting most of the time.
I can listen to the audio, and I've got all the CDs. I listen to them in the car on long journeys and stuff. And I can watch any of the animations, even that bad Web of Fear one, and just think, well, okay, at least not all six episodes were like this. You know what I mean? I can't do telly snaps. I can't do the loose cannon constructions. I couldn't do the John Kelly construction here. And even when I went to see Enemy and Web when they released them at the Prince Charles Cinema, about a year after they came out, I think it was.
Yeah.
I went out and had a walk during episode 3 of The Web of Fear because I just can't sit through telly snap. I just don't have the attention span to do it, I think. So I think they cater different things. But I remember being intensely disappointed that we didn't get animations because I think around that time, I think it was Planet 55, for me, it seemed to have kind of cracked it with the moon base. Where they've got a very stylized and yet very faithful reimagining of what those two missing episodes would have looked like. And I think, to the best of my knowledge, they were the ones who had started animating The Underwater Menace. And also the fact that there's, you know, some stuff that goes on, especially in episode 4 with the sinking of Atlantis. I'd love to see that. I'd love to see a visual representation of it. There isn't just, you know, stills of Polly going... And, you know, like Zaroff drowning or whatever, you know.
Yeah, minute on Zaroff drowning is a bit...
That's it, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Because the soundtrack to that sounds so... Because the audio does sound epic. Because the sound design sounds really good.
I think the animations suffer a little bit when they do what they did on The Evil of the Daleks, which is they animate the existing episode. Because then you see how much is actually... I mean, it's fair enough. I mean, you've only got so much budget and time to work with. And obviously you don't know with the missing episodes, nobody knows what's actually happening on screen necessarily. There's the bit in episode 2 of Evil of the Daleks where Jamie and the Doctor are in the antique shop And there's some lovely sort of little physical touches and bits of comedy and stuff that's going on that's there in the actual existing episode. And then you go and watch the animation and it's not there at all.
Yeah, it's very... People want different things from the animations, don't they?
Yeah.
And it seems to be a younger trend. I mean, I put on Twitter recently with the Abominable Snowman. I did a poll saying, will you watch it with the original footage still in there?
Yeah.
Or watch it through as animated? And bearing in mind that my social media following, as it were, will be mostly crusty old missing episode farts, about a third said they would watch it all animated. And I don't think I have many younger people interacting with me on social media.
Apart from me, of course.
Apart from Hayden, who's, you know, still in short trousers. But I find it interesting how people want different things from them. Yeah. I watched the Macra Terror, and you see it, well, they called it reimagined, so that because they didn't want to do the rough and tumble scene in episode one, so they called it a reimagining. But it is reimagined because it's done in a widescreen format, so it's all re-blocked. It's all on a. It all seems to be on a vast soundstage, with giant wild, you know, crabs who can do somersaults and stuff. And it just depends on what you're trying to get to it. And there's got to be a line somewhere where you are trying to recreate what is missing and trying to fuel the imagination so that you can imagine what it's like. And that's my attitude to it. And then trying to do a genuine piece of entertainment. But it's almost getting to the point sometimes where you might as well ditch the original audio and do a whole new thing. Did you see what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't know where that line is.
I'm somebody who always wants to watch as close to what would have been broadcast on screen as possible. So I've had mixed feelings about a lot of the animations. I mean, I sort of enjoy them for what they are, and certainly it's enabled me to sit down and watch a couple of them with one of my housemates once, because who wouldn't have watched them otherwise? You know, they wouldn't have sat down and watched a loose cannon recon with me. I think you're right, Tim. I think it is younger people, perhaps, because, you know, when we get the, what do you call it, when they do the new graphics for the old episodes, when they do the...
It's a new special effect.
Yeah, so they do the new improved special effects these days a lot, don't they? On certain episodes and things. And I'm just not... I've never watched them. I often refer to the Kinder CGI snake, which I don't think is, for me, is any better than the snake that appears on screen. Because CGI dates horribly, I think it can do, especially, you know, relatively cheap CGI. And I'm just not interested in the special editions. All I want to see is what was broadcast, you know, on that day, whenever it was shown in 1965, 1973, whenever it was, you know, that's what I want to see.
Well, apparently on the forthcoming Blu-ray collections of the Peter Davison era, they give you the option of switching to watch where they've CGI adjusted it. So that Adric's walking looks natural.
Oh, you... you bully. My poor Adric.
I can take or leave the special effects. Sometimes they crap.
Yeah, I must say, although the one at the end of the second Auton story, you know, the one with the carnival heads, where they've got the two dishes turned towards each other and the nesting materialised in the middle of it, that's quite a good one.
The thing about special effects is it's optional, isn't it? If you don't want it, you don't have to have it. But obviously with the animations, it's different, isn't it?
So here's a question for you then. You hit the key word there, optional. So you can watch it without and you can watch it with.
Mm.
So when the Season 2 Blu-ray comes out and you can only watch a version that has the fixes in the chase, for instance.
Mm.
Where they turn a scene that was obviously daylight into night because Richard Martin cocked it up. And when they take out all the stagehands and when they take out the scanner graphic going over the Daleks' lens and all of that, would you rather be forced to see the original, which was terrible, or a slightly less terrible one that has been fixed by the restoration team?
No, I'm sorry, I'd still go for the original personally, but...
Really? Thing is, when I used to watch the whole almost the whole run of them on UK Gold in the mid-90s. I mean, a lot of them were quite terrible quality. But that would have been possibly the quality that people were watching them on TVs in the 60s. But I still think it looks better when it's cleaned up.
Yeah, again, you get this line between engineering and art and fixing decisions that were made in the past. On BritBox, I've watched a couple, just for the same reason as Hayden said earlier, it's far easier just to change the channel than it is to go and find the DVD. And I don't know why, well, I have some understanding how it comes about, but on BritBox, they've got some of the VHS masters on there for Doctor Who, rather than the vid-fired alternative. And I put the Crotons on, and I found it almost unwatchable. I found it just because we've been spoiled. But again, there's a line that they cross between doing good engineering to try and sensibly put extra frames in there to reimagine how it was on video. But then they start to try and fix things. And again, there's a line. I want to see a boom coming in, but I understand why people don't.
Mm.
So it's just fascinating. And the Underwater Menace DVD is one end of that range of ways we can watch and appreciate Doctor Who missing episodes. They're even coming out on vinyl now. What is that about?
If you're going to take a boom out, wouldn't you find some way of editing out the Billy Fluffs? Or even not just Billy, but just any actor. Just that thing where they'll stumble on a line, but they'll continue because it's not so bad that they need to restart the scene.
Yep.
But I think that makes it almost more natural.
Yeah.
To do it like that. But there we are.
Like I said, I'm interested in the television show. I'm interested in the history of it. And that's why I don't need that. I don't need it varnishing. I don't need it tarting up, personally.
But you then have a situation where you've got BBC America with all the money saying, we want to show the animated ones, forget the ones that exist. So animate two episodes that are missing of the faceless ones so that we can put it out. And I find that, I'm not saying anything is right or wrong. No. I just find it really interesting about the many different... I have a preference as an old fart about what I want to watch. But I bet the majority would want to watch an animated one and do with the audio what you please. Doc, they've been editing the audio since the invasion. If they have a stretch of silence that they don't know what to do with, they'll edit it. There's only a couple which are totally and utterly faithful to like the camera scripts and the audio.
I think a good example, I don't know if they do it with all of them, the Charlton era, but when they did the animated Fury, do you want to watch it in black and white or colour? That's, it gives you the option, although some people were furious over that, didn't they? Oh, well, you can't watch it in colour. That's absolutely wrong.
Well, if you're going to watch the animation, you might as well watch it in colour, I think. Because what's the point of watching it in black and white? Just because it's not anything like what was shown on screen anyway, so why?
Well, what's even better now is you can watch it in 4:3 or widescreen. And so, sorry, Mark, but I watch in black and white and 4:3. But I like that they give that choice.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that some things like Behind the Sofa, and occasionally they'll pop, say, the Tom Baker years.
Yeah.
Yeah.
On one of the discs. There's not that much that you're getting that's not on the, wasn't on the DVDs, is there?
There's a few documentaries, but it is mostly, it's mostly stuff that a large majority of it, I'd say, is stuff that was on the DVDs anyway, because it's still great and they're good interviews. And also, sadly, a lot of those interviews are with people who aren't around to make new interviews anymore, so which is a shame.
Exactly.
As part of my prep, I've done nothing with it, because I had an inkling, for some reason, that Tim was going to want to talk about the representation of missing episodes in media. And I happened to be in a charity shop in a local town, Faversham, and I saw a cabinet and I purchased it from the BBC Radio Collection, Doctor Who, The Daleks Master Plan.
Brilliant.
The double CD, which I got for a fiver. Not double CD, sorry, I mean it's...
Three in there, isn't there, I think?
Five.
Five? Oh, yeah, of course.
13! No, it's a five, yeah. Damn it, the boxes. I can't shut it now.
And it was worth every penny, listeners.
Well, it's £5. Well, I looked online and they generally sell for between £10 to £25. There's a few that haven't sold that were online for about £40. But nobody's ever paid 40 quid for it. So 5 quid was a...
That was one of my go-to audiobooks, actually. Audio collection series was Dalek's Master Plan. Had that in the car for ages.
Unfortunately, I haven't had a time to start listening to it yet, but it indeed is going to be sitting in my car and will be joining me on the various journeys, so I'm looking forward to that.
I made a little list of the many ways that we can enjoy missing episodes or, you know, examine missing episodes. And when you think, just top of my head, of all the stuff that is missing in the archive, you get some top-range stuff like Sherlock Holmes, which is missing. And they don't have the audio. And if they sometimes when they do have the audio, you might get a bit of a recon or something.
Mm.
But the vast majority of stuff, you know, United! Which ran for hundreds of episodes.
Yes.
Written by Brian Hales. There's nothing that exists. Zilch. Nada. I think there might be a trailer. And that's all that exists of hundreds of episodes. And, you know, if you're a missing episodes bod, or interested in missing episodes, script books, telesnaps in their own right, audios, which we're damn lucky to have. And some audios we've got 5 different recordings of. Isn't that crazy? That we've managed to somehow as a fandom preserve 5 different copies of some stories of the missing episodes from kids with reel-to-reel tape recorders. So you've got those audios, you've got audios with narration, they're now coming out on vinyl. You've got target books, you've got narrated target books on audio. And then we've got all host of recons from Loose Cannon and their predecessors. All this fan stuff on YouTube, all manner of animations. I just think it's remarkable. Mm. I really do. I think it's brilliant.
I've said this before, but the thing that I remember most about Doctor Who as a kid, he's not watching the stuff. I can picture myself watching things like the Sea Devils, but the things that stand most in my mind is all the stuff that I used to do between seasons. So it's the target books, my furious argument with my sister when her dog chewed up my Terence Dix monster book. You know, getting the cassette of Pescatons and the LP of Genesis for Christmases, that sort of thing. And I can remember those sharpness. Whereas when people well, yes, I watched, I remember watching Marco Polo, and they'll say, yes, I can remember these specific details. I'm sure you can't remember that. You don't really remember that if you watched it on DVDs. But I think that one of the best things about Doctor Who fandom is not necessarily the new stories. It's all the stuff you do when the series isn't on TV. I mean, I've not read a Target book, for God. Well, I've read a couple of the new ones by... Is it James Goss who does quite some of that good ones? Didn't he do a Sharda and... Didn't he do Pirate Planet? Those would be very... And he did a one I really enjoyed was... We did City of Death. And there's some really good stuff in there. Like when they do Kerensky dying in the time field from reverse. Anyway, we are nearly 3 hours. And no, I think it's an indication of how well it's gone, Tim, that neither Hayden nor Mark has moaned yet. Because usually by about 2 hours, 10 minutes, they're saying, oh, can we bring it to a close, please?
Yeah, well, we've got a guest that can't do that today.
Oh, you just mean me being polite.
And it's been genuinely interesting.
So, I wish I'd picked up more on the fact that it wasn't actually the Underwater Menace itself that we're going to discuss. Then we'll have to watch it this afternoon.
I could do an hour on that if you want.
4 episodes of Joseph First going, I mean, at least if he'd done his line from Diamonds Are Forever... Will you get out of here, you irritating little man? That would be far better than nothing in the world can stop me now. This Professor Zaroff, by the way, is a scientific genius who can be defeated by their inability to store fresh seafood. So, a scientific genius who can't invent a fridge. But it was as bad as I remember, really. Could have been better. Jamie's only just met Ben. But when Ben says, I'm going to have a deco arm here. But Jamie says, me too.
Then I think we ought to go back.
No, not me. I'm in a deco arm here.
Yeah, me too.
Ben might easily be saying, I'm going to have a piss around the corner while I'm here. I suppose a good example of this, with the multiple ways you can do things, is there's so many bloody ways that they've done Sharda. From Tom Baker's Sharda to whatever. Anyway, let us bring things to a close. Tim, it's been a brilliant to see you. We shall put a DVD of The Underwater Menace into one of our display cases here. And we'll have to have you back, actually.
Oh, I'd love to. I'd love to. Just say the word.
So who's this coming down the corridor? Someone says, oh, it's Uncle Terence come to say goodbye. Uncle Terence, we're going to be visiting your event next week. Have you got any messages you'd like us to take to your fans?
Yes, we got the two volumes of the Essential Terence Dix. Volume 1 and Volume 2 is currently out in the shops.
So I also understand that the Riverside location is going to be on the north side of the Thames. So Mark, being in Kent, is going to have to cross over the River Thames. Have you got any advice for him, how he should behave as he's crossing the bridge?
Yes, sir, you'll do very well to avoid that bloody Dalek, Mark, which comes out of the water. But otherwise, you're just going to have to stop dumping bodies in the river.
Oh, rats. But I've got a car boot full of them, and I was... I'm just going to have to go down some country lane again, aren't I?
Uncle Terence. We have enemy ships in Sector 47.
Is it 47 or 27?
It ought to be 47.
It's a trap.
Bye-bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Cheerio.
You have been listening to the Diddly Dum Podcast. Find us on our blog at diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com, on iTunes, Facebook, Audioboo, and Stitcher.com at diddlydum, on Twitter at diddly_dum, or email us at diddlydumpodcast@yahoo.co.uk. Diddly Dum. Meaty, not runny. Top breeders recommend it because it's solid nourishment for the ears.